This is Friday the 13th, February 1998. We're interviewing Justice of the Peace Judge Diana M. Orozco, Precinct 6, Place 1.
That's right.
How'd you get here? Tell me the story.
How did I get here as the Justice of the Peace?
Yes.
It was probably just an issue of principle. I wasn't happy with the person who was running and who was basically, it was more of a situation of for work he had done in the community in the past that it was just assumed he was going to take this position. And a justice of the peace having to deal with all the legal issues, I felt that since this was going to be the first time in the history of Dallas County that we were going to have the opportunity to elect Hispanic justice of the peace, that I felt it should be someone that was an attorney and that had better experience and better knowledge than the person that was kind of agreed upon by the powers to be that was going to take this position.
This is Trini Garza?
Right.
In Dallas County, you're not required to be an attorney?
You're not required in the state of Texas.
All right.
Yeah. JP, and I think actually it's the Supreme Court of the United States. Some of the two judicial positions that you're not required to be an attorney.
So how did you win?
Well,
that made you decide to run, but how did you
win? It was a very good experience in my life because I can remember very clearly and so many times it was a very quick decision, a very quick process. It was really only about a probably 7-week period that I had to make my decision and get going to the time of election. And Mr. Garza was a school board trustee, had name ID. Basically, everybody was telling me it was basically going to be a race on principle and that I didn't have a chance of winning. So there were many, many times that I decided I was going to drop out. And I came extremely close to dropping out of the race many times. Actually at the beginning part two in making the decision. But basically what I decided, I thought, well, I'm going to give it my best shot. And I just basically decided to walk the district. And I remember I ended up walking 900 households in about 4 weeks. I ended up getting blisters on my vocal cords. But I think that's what made the difference. Did get some advice from some people how you run a campaign in a single member district in terms of, I think I had one major mail out and basically I had a different material that I would hand out when I would walk door to door, but I tried to distinguish myself from my opponent and basically saying I have the experience as an attorney, he does not. And I think another big issue that I guess was one that killed LBJ years ago is the notion of trying to do two jobs or running while you are in an elected position. Mr. Garza was a sitting school board trustee and he was running for JP and had announced that he would not resign his school trustee position. And I used that and I found that really that was something that the public did not like at all. They didn't like the notion of a politician or elected official trying to do two jobs at the same time or to have two positions at the same time. So I just kept hitting on those two issues in terms of my experience and that I would not have another elected position so that I could better serve the public, and it worked.
Were there any other candidates?
No, we were the only two.
Nobody in November?
No Republicans ran in the district. It's a heavily Democratic district. So.
How much money did you raise? How much money did you spend?
I pretty much spent what I raised. Again, initially, it was kind of hard going because so many people felt I didn't have a chance. But so, initially I had to spend some of my own money, but it pretty much recouped. And it was under $10,000. It was probably about $8,000 to $10,000.
How did you raise?
Actually, most of the monies came from people that had known me in the community. I've been very active in Democratic politics. I've been to two national conventions. So, I had a lot of people that supported me. It just took a while to get, to have to raise the money. And then I got a lot of my funds were from attorneys, just from the Mexican-American Bar, because I was a president of the Mexican-American Bar. So a lot of, you know, a lot of attorneys contributed as well.
These conventions you attended, was that as a delegate or as an observer?
As a delegate. I've been to the, I was a Gore delegate in the Atlanta convention, and then I was a delegate in the New York convention. I think it was Paul Tsongas at that time.
What years were those, do you remember?
88 was my first convention, and I think 92. Is that right? 92, remember? Not in 92.
What was that experience like? Tell me a little bit about the going into those conventions.
The 88 experience was a much better experience for me. I mean, I grew up loving politics, and you know, I can remember being, you know, 8 years old, 12 years old. I mean, I used to watch the gavel to gavel of the conventions. My mother would just love politics and would take me to rallies and things like that. And so I had an interest in politics from since very young. And, you know, I guess it was kind of one of my dreams to go to a national convention. So the 88 convention was like, you know, it was very exciting for me, just, you know. It was a good experience, too, to see the process and how you get there. But by the New York convention, it didn't seem so exciting to me anymore. But I know at the 88 convention, I think a thing that made the difference is I had really, from step one, worked as a campaign volunteer for Al Gore. And so I think I cared a little bit more about the candidate, and that's why it made a difference by the time I went to the convention. And, you know, I'm used to, as we all are, seeing the conventions had some mystery or some excitement in them before, and now they're pretty much done deals, and there's no suspense as to who's going to get nominated anymore. So,
how expensive is it to go to these national conventions?
It's very, well, I mean, obviously to go to New York. I can remember for Atlanta at the time, too, even though I was an attorney and, you know, I had my own practice and things like that, but there were many other delegates that had kind of parties to raise money, because, I mean, it's, you know, you have to pay for your hotel expense, and you know, so it can be quite expensive.
How do you struggle to get to become delegate from step one all the way up? Tell me about some of those skirmishes, some of those deals, some of the trading.
I mean, some of the thing in terms of the Texas Democratic Party rules and is that they want the delegation to reflect society, and so they had some rules in terms of male-female ratio, having sufficient Hispanic representation, having sufficient representation of African Americans. And I believe it was the 88 convention. The way I got selected was not necessarily out of my precinct or out of my delegation, but at the state convention when they were trying to balance, then you have the Gore delegates or the Gore delegation basically looking at the names that can be selected, and they have knowledge of, you know, is this someone who just wants to go to a convention, or is this someone who's really committed to Al Gore? And so that's how I got on at the 88 convention, because not only were they lacking in women, and not only were they lacking in trying to find Hispanic delegates, but I was among the Gore state people at the top of the list. I mean, they knew the work that I had done and the time that I had spent on the campaign here in Dallas County. So that's how I got on. Now, what was interesting was in the 92 convention, I got voted out of my delegation at the state convention. And actually, that was out of a very white district. And both, it was Eric Moyer, an African American, and myself were the two that got voted out of that district. It was the 8th senatorial district at the time.
So how did you get back in?
That was kind of interesting that in New York, I got voted out of my delegation.
So how did you get back in, or you mean you got voted out at New York?
No, in other words, for the New York convention, I got voted by my senatorial district to be the representative to go to New York. I'm just saying the distinction being, I mean, it was, we remember that, you know, it was an African-American and a Hispanic that got voted out. In other words, we weren't chosen because we were trying to balance the delegation. Just purely by our delegation, we got voted to be the representatives to go.
You threw me out. Yeah. Voted out.
Voted out, okay.
Well, tell me the story about the creation of this first JP districts for Mexican-Americans.
Well, this is really kind of almost on the tail end of a period that we may not see for quite some time, given the makeup of our judiciary and some very, very right-wing decisions that have come from the Fifth Circuit regarding voting rights cases. The city of Dallas had just come off a very, I mean, I think that controversy went from 1988 to probably 91. So a long period of conflict in terms of our city politics in trying to redistrict to give minorities the opportunity to elect candidates of their choice under the Voting Rights Act. There had been a lawsuit pending and so many twists and turns in that City of Dallas case. It seemed it was constantly in the news for that period of time. And the city had basically, upon a finding by Judge Buckmeyer, that there had been a history of discrimination and there had been a history of minorities not being able to elect candidates of their choice. There had finally, at the end of everything, been a settlement for a single member district plan that did give Hispanics and African Americans more representation on the city council. Kind of on the heels of that litigation, there was litigation against Dallas County. Dallas County had never elected a Hispanic Justice of the Peace. The districts were such that of the, I think at that time there were about 11 or 12 some on JPs. They were basically all Anglo, were all white, except I think the previous election there had been African Americans elected. So certainly there was no Hispanic representation, and given the numbers of the new census and what we knew in terms of the districts that we had drawn in the city of Dallas, we knew that there was a possibility to have districts, that at least one district that we could elect a Hispanic JP. And I think a little bit surprising at the time, the county commissioners were pretty receptive. I think they had seen what the city had gone through. They weren't interested in long drawn out litigation. Probably some backroom deals about who, maybe who, I'm sure there were some commissioners who had in mind what Hispanics they wanted to run for that position, so they were kind of interested in settling it and weren't really opposed to it. It was basically, though, having to satisfy the African American community that they weren't going to lose their district and being able to have a district with sufficient Hispanic population. So that litigation wasn't as hard fought and didn't have the conflict that the City of Dallas case had. And basically the county commissioners settled the lawsuit and the parties came to an agreement. So the district was created.
Were you a plaintiff or were you an attorney or were you related to anybody there?
I was a co-attorney on the case. I was not the lead attorney on the case, but just basically had done some of the legal work on the pending case against the county.
Who was the lead attorney?
Bill Garrett.
Okay. Well, tell me about the position then. What is it you do? How many hours do you work? What's the caseload? What's the salary?
Well, it's a great job. Initially, I think the part of the job that I enjoy the most, and it is the most challenging, is the work that we do with truants in these courts. Initially, when I took office in January of 1995, and in fact, part of the campaign, all you would hear in this North Oak Cliff area from the public was how bad a truancy problem we had. I mean, you could just literally walk the streets and see the kids on the streets. during the day, the middle of the day. We had police officers very concerned about the fact that the school district didn't seem to do much about the truancy issue. So that was a big issue, and I quickly learned why it was a problem. I took office in January of 95, and from January to May of 95, they didn't file more than 100 cases in this court. I found out that there was one man that the school district hired that was in charge of all the 240 some odd schools in the district. So clearly it was a joke. They weren't taking it seriously. At that time, one of the news stations, Channel 8, was doing some reports on other issues at one of the high schools, Sunset High School. And then this issue came up. So I remember it was in the either late part of the spring or early summer that they got some bad publicity. They had showed these kids, interviewed the kids, 50 some odd absences, and, you know, had never been filed on by the school district. To the district's benefit, I mean, they reacted. And that summer, they developed a program. They hired, I think it was at that time, 12 persons to work on the program with all the schools. So just to give you a comparison, the very next year, January of 96 to May of 96, in this court and Judge Hassel's court, we had over 2,000 cases filed. It has made a tremendous difference, and it has opened my eyes just hearing the volume of cases to so many problems that we have, not just with our parents and the lack of parenting skills, the help that they need, the help that they're not getting from schools or from other agencies that they could receive, but even some of the problems at the school. So that has been the work that I have at least been able to see that I have made a difference, and that there is so much more that can be done. Because you basically have the kids come before you, and it's like the very beginning part, like the red flag of so many problems. So, I mean, what this court does is we're able to refer them to get the help, refer the families to get the help, and I think an important part of this job is, as well, that I'm able to hold the school district accountable for what they're supposed to do. We had an issue this year regarding textbooks. I've had heard this problem since I took office. The kids come to me, they say they don't have a textbook to take home. They're issued a classroom text, a book they can only use in their classroom. And even though I knew that the Office of Civil Rights had been starting an investigation on this matter and the school district entered into an agreement that they were going to start providing the books, lo and behold, here I am a year later. We were in late November and I was having kids tell me the same thing. They did not have books. So, I mean, that's just one of many issues that at least I have the power to subpoena those principals into my courtroom and get an explanation where perhaps our immigrant parents or our parents who aren't educated, and so that's not part of their experience to know that that's not normal. They're not certainly going to question the school district. So I think what has been so beneficial is that I am able to call them in. I know better, and I know that that's not appropriate. And to basically question them and try to get some answers, throw some light, even if it's bad publicity, if that's what it takes, to get them to start doing what they're supposed to be doing.
In these past 4 years, what's been your average caseload? How many cases do you hear a year?
Oh, gosh. That's hard to say. These courts hear their original jurisdiction for all eviction matters. We probably get about, it just varies because summer months are different, but probably average about 200 eviction cases a month. This district isn't as heavy as some of the other JP districts are for evictions, but we hear small claims matters as well and civil cases. Then we also have criminal docket. We have traffic court. Traffic cases are filed with these courts, and the kind of the other big thing, we probably get about 400 cases a month or so on issuance of a bad check cases. So they're interesting courts in that we run the gamut of from civil to criminal. So we kind of have to brush up on our lawn on pretty much all of the areas.
That sounds like about 1,000 cases a month.
It's difficult for me to say how many are filed. It fluctuates. And another thing is, because these are new districts, I know this is like the third year, but it's every year the amount of cases we've seen it slowly increase. So.
And that means you get more staff?
The county does have a system by which they, if we get more cases, we get more staff.
What's your salary?
What's my salary? Ooh, I think it started at 63, and I think now the county, I think we're at 68.
And the weddings, how many weddings do you do, and that money, do you get the extra compensation?
That has always been an issue with JPs, and I'll tell you, there's a big difference in what a Justice of the Peace here in Oak Cliff makes and a Justice of the Peace downtown Dallas. The reason being is when people go get their certificates, they can go to the records building, get their certificate, walk across to the George Allen building, find a district court judge and get a waiver, and then there are two JPs in that office. So I always tease my colleagues over there about how they're making too much money. It's incredible how much, really how much traffic they get through there in terms of doing weddings. But that is one part. The JP positions are supposed to be part-time. So even as an attorney, I can have a practice apart from being a JP. There are JPs who have other professions and do it sort of part-time. I don't think it can be done part-time. And I think it's more challenging than that it really does need more attention than a part-time. But apart from that, you do get to keep your wedding money, which has always been an issue, and it comes up, it seems, every legislative session about taking those monies away. And I think in some part, I can understand, in other words, here JP's marrying people for what people seem to think is on county time, 8 to 4:30. But again, if you look back to the notion that we're not on a time clock, we're not salaried in that respect, and we're part-time, but we're really technically not on county time. So I'm sure it's an issue that's gonna keep coming up. But here just trying to make a guess. I mean, there are weeks I go and I don't do a wedding, and then they're like this week, since it's Valentine's, I'm probably gonna do about 5 weddings or so. So, I mean, it's not anything real heavy.
What's the fee?
The fee here, Judge Hasso and I basically try to agree on a fee for this area. And if they come during business hours, it's $50. If it's that we have to go to their home, it's about $100. I mean, sometimes I've been asked to go to McKinney, Texas, or Bulk Springs, or, way out or something, and I might charge a little bit more if it's going to take more time.
Okay. You're running for re-election?
Yes.
How did you decide that, or why did you decide? You love this tremendously?
It's a good job. I'm enjoying it, and I do see, you can't ask for more to have a job that you feel you're making a difference. And I think, especially with these truancy cases, that I'm making a big difference.
Do you have a side practice?
No. No. Initially, I had, when I ran for office, I was in private practice. And actually, it's taken me this long to get rid of what I had. And in fact, I think I've got one more case to finish out that's a hangover from, holdover from when I had my private practice. When I started, I was taking some cases, but I quickly, realized that it was too much. The focus in terms of getting this office the way I wanted it and retraining my staff, that I needed to spend more time. So
there was a controversy with the JPs that were here before physically. Thomas Jones, was the JP here. And he didn't want to leave, and finally ended up, didn't want to take his cases, or took his cases. Can you tell me that story?
I think the main issue, and I don't know, I think there might have been some personal political problems between Commissioner Price and Thomas Jones, and maybe that's why some of the conflict. And my only understanding was that there had been a building that was promised to Judge Jones. And what happened is, basically at the last minute, that building fell through in terms of the county being able to purchase. So at that point, Judge Jones decided, well, then I don't want a new building. I want to stay here. But the commissioners pretty much felt that since this was going to be the first Hispanic district and kind of the life of this, of our Hispanic North Oak Cliff area is this Jefferson Boulevard, they wanted this facility to be the Hispanic district facility. So they were not willing to budge on that issue. It didn't really matter to Judge Hasso or to myself, and we pretty much stayed out of that issue. But they evidently found a building. He was placed in like a provisional strip shopping center that was pretty bad. I mean, it was a pretty bad situation, but it didn't last very long. And now he's got a beautiful facility. They found a building. He got to have it basically renovated to his taste and to his likings, and he has beautiful offices.
Let's switch tracks here for a minute. Who do you think is the most effective political leader for Mexican Americans today at any level?
The most effective? I don't think we have one.
Okay. Most effective Mexican American organization for Mexican Americans?
I think that on a national level, probably that LULAC, because of its reputation and at least perception, has some influence. But I couldn't say that I, in my opinion, that I think we're very effective.
What organizations do you belong to?
Well, I used to be very active with the Mexican American Democrats, but that's kind of one example of how we shoot ourselves in the foot. I mean, that thing splintered into Tejano Democrats, and basically I just stayed out of that whole fight and basically a wait and see attitude of what was going to happen. I don't think we're very effective. As few as we are, we're splintered into several groups and factions. So I'm really not, though I know Tejano Democrat sends me a lot of information, I have yet to join that organization. And I didn't keep up my dues with Mexican American Democrats. And I know my family and myself, I used to be on the board and very active with the American GI Forum some years back, but have not kept up that.
How about MABA?
Still a member of the Mexican American Bar. The Mexican American Bar is an organization here in Dallas that I think, when called upon, could have a lot of influence. There's always a struggle, I think, within that association as to whether we're going to be political, whether we're not going to be political. We were of tremendous benefit during the redistricting issue, for example. And most of the members did get very much involved, and I think made a difference. But there are so many issues that if you want to call it political, I'd just call it being advocates for our community. But I think there are so many issues, even just with the things that go on in the courthouse, that are not necessarily fair to Spanish-speaking public, that we should be a little bit more aggressive. But there's always that struggle within that organization.
By the way, do you have an opponent to this re-election bid?
Oh, I won't have to run for two more years, so I haven't heard of anybody, but who knows? You know, probably find out right before.
Oh, they staggered the council's terms and your term.
They staggered the terms, and my term was initially a two-year term, and then after my two-year term, nobody ran against me. So I basically ran unopposed for 4 years. So I'm in till the year 2000.
So you ran in 96 again?
Right.
Wow, almost.
No, yeah, not right.
Almost two elections, like almost within
right,
a year
back
and a half.
Back to back.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thank you. Thank God. I mean, after having really what was really a very tough campaign, then I guess it paid off all the work I did, because perhaps it scared anybody off from filing.
Future plans? Do you plan to run for any other office?
No, you know, I've got a 2.5-year-old and I'm expecting a child right now, so it's kind of gonna have to put those decisions a little bit on hold, but keeping my mind open for other options and possibilities. So.
Would you accept an appointment to a higher judiciary position, or?
Oh, certainly, I would. I've enjoyed being a judge, and I think, if anything else, too, what this position, just being involved in politics this close and being a judge, as well, has opened my eyes to how difficult it is for our elected officials to keep integrity. And it's a concern I have, and I'm afraid that I remember hearing someone talking about what's been going on with politics, that it's almost like the scum is what rises to the top, and it's only if you have a lack of integrity that you're able to get ahead. And maybe that's, I'm just not there yet, I'm not that cynical about it yet, but there's no question about it that you're challenged, I think, personally, in many ways. On many issues. I mean, justice of the peace is way down the ladder. You hear your colleagues or your people, well, you can't rule that way. You're going to upset the landlords, and they're the ones who give monies to get you elected. And just so many examples in county government and as a judge of what I hear and what I see. And I basically see people, politicians, my colleagues, accepting that as being okay. And they may be right. I mean, that may be what's going to get you ahead, but I'm not there yet. I'm not that cynical to believe that that's what you have to do to get elected.
Black-brown relations, what is the underpinnings of tension? What are they?
Well, that I think our Hispanic numbers, our population's increasing tremendously, and that basically it's threatening to African Americans. And then I think the other issues that we all have to be very frank and very blunt about, be truthful with ourselves. And that is that we all grew up in the same society, so we all have prejudices, we all have racism and racist notions and beliefs that are part of our belief system, and we have them. We grew up with them. And we have to fight them constantly. And some people don't fight them. And it's been difficult in the past when we've tried, even with white-black relations, to hear African Americans say, we can't be racist. That's just simply not true. And then the same thing from Hispanics, well, we were discriminated, we can't be racist. Well, we know that's not true. And so I think there's always going to be a problem, because we were raised and born in a system, in a society that has many racist systemic problems. It's like I say, and what I see, especially with our children, a lot of the kids that come through my court, I mean, I've had them come in here and say, you know, if you're on the drill team, if you're on the honor roll, if you're doing well in school, they say, what are you doing? You're trying to be white. I mean, that's the level, at which they've internalized that to be successful is to be white. I mean, we're really sunk if that's what's in their head, because that's what they observe. And, you know, I think we have to start looking from the eyes of a child. I mean, what does a child see? A child sees that his neighborhood doesn't have the nice flowers, isn't well maintained, but if you go to North Dallas, you see a different world. What message does that give them? The fact that here at Sunset and Adamson, our kids are in schools that are 99% Hispanic. We never think about, well, what's the message to that kid? Whites don't want to go to school with me? It's the same thing as I tell, you know, Anglos or whites in this city. I mean, what message are you giving your kid when the only people you socialize with are whites? Or when your dad belongs to a law firm and there are no black or Hispanic partners? We don't have to be vicious and hateful and outwardly, but just by the way we're living, we send messages to our kids and have created generation upon generation of attitudes and discriminatory beliefs. And that follows us with a lot of decisions we make, whether we realize it or not. So, I mean, I think that's the very basic that's always with us in problems of race relations. And I think what we're seeing here in Dallas, though, getting to very specific things, is, my gosh, we've got a Hispanic population that's just, that's booming. And I think there's, right now, the majority-minority group is Hispanics, and by the year 2000, I think it's projected to be the first grade, the kindergarten and first grade is projected to be something like 60%. That's got to be very threatening to African-Americans who may feel that they're going to lose. They have fought so hard for certain gains and, you know, may feel that they're about to lose a lot of the gains that they made. So I think there's some of that that's going on as well.
Chicano-Mexicano relations, what ought they be? In both directions, Chicanos with Mexicans, Mexicans with Chicanos.
I think, I mean, and I don't know, I mean, I think it's improved somewhat, but I see that conflictive as well, maybe for some of the same reasons, maybe more classist than anything. And as someone who lived in Mexico City for a year, it's a different world, and certainly their society struggles with the same things, extreme racism in terms of their Indian population as opposed to their Spanish population, or so a lot of those tendencies, I think, overflow as well. And then I think in terms of here in the U.S., in Dallas, for instance, I do still see a lot of conflict with Mexican-Americans as opposed to immigrants, new immigrants, and some issues of resentment that they're here and that they're not supportive of some immigrant rights and certain issues regarding immigrants. So I think there's still work to do there, too, as well.
What is leadership?
What is leadership? I think it's being confident in yourself, to have your own integrity, to know what's right and what's wrong, and then to take those issues forward. What I've been so disappointed with politicians that I've seen lately, at every level, is that politics has become, you know, you hire a firm that's going to run your campaign, and they're going to tell you what the issues are. Or let's walk outside and put our finger up in the air and see which way the wind is blowing, what's popular, and that's what your agenda is going to be. That's not leadership. As opposed to you having the integrity to know what's right and wrong and leading, presenting it to the public. And we've lost that. And I think it's, the results of it are very scary.
You'll have a baby here soon, a couple of weeks or sooner?
Yeah, about 3 weeks or so.
3 weeks. And you had one before. You said mm-hmm. 2.5-year-old. So you've been in office during all this time.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to your caseload? What kind of maternity leave do you get? How does that impact on your job?
Well, interestingly, with my first child, since it was my first year, I was a little concerned and didn't want to spend time away from the office. I had a C-section and I took 2 weeks off. It was tough. I, in retrospect, should not have done that. I took 2 weeks completely off and then came back and would come back and do my docket. And then, you know, after 2 weeks, so a total of 4 weeks, came back full time. I'm still struggling with that this time. I know I'm probably going to need, this is going to be a C-section as well, that I'm going to need to take more time than that. I'm trying to convince myself that I got to practice what I preach, and what I always tell these parents that come before me is that, you know, your children come first. They come before work. They come before everything. And I better practice what I preach, and I think I'm going to take more time off than that. I mean, obviously, as the judge in this court, I have the freedom to schedule the way I want to schedule the cases and set the cases when I want to set the cases. I've been working doubly hard, especially with the truancy cases, to hear them all before I go in for the C-section. So we won't be backlogged, at least until the date I leave.
So there is no substitute? I mean, the cases just pile up, or do you and Judge Hassel have an arrangement?
Well, for instance, one of the things that just can't be put off, there are certain cases that cannot be put off. You can't just reset them, which are evictions. The law says the case has to be heard within a certain amount of time. So Judge Hassel hears that docket for me while I'm gone. And, you know, when he's gone, goes to judge's school or has conflict, then I hear his cases as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's switch over then to personal background. Take your pick. Tell me about your family. Who is Diana Orozco? Or tell me about your early childhood and your educational accomplishments.
I feel very fortunate that, I mean, I was from two parents that valued education tremendously. My dad was an educator, was a teacher, and was a principal here with the school district for about 15 years. So that was obviously a very important part of our life, and I think just kind of drummed into our head about how important education in school was. Again, I hear the truancy cases here, and I said, you know, there's a difference in what you tell your kids and then what you do. And, you know, I have such a vivid memory of my father, you know, working three jobs. He used to sell shoes at Sears, and he used to teach English as a second language in the evenings, apart from his full-time day job, to make extra money because he wanted my brother to go to Jesuit, which is a private school and was, you know, very expensive at the time for them. They took out loans. They did all kinds of things to get us to go to what they thought were the best schools in the city. So I obviously, knowing what my parents had to go through, and we worked as well. My sister and I both we both went to Ursuline Academy, and we, you know, after school and the summers before, in between, worked cleaning the nuns, the convent, and the house. So that made a big difference in terms of me valuing education.
Can we get names here? Father's name, mother's name, sister's name, brother's name?
Yeah. I have, my father is Alberto Perez Orozco, and my mother is Enriqueta Gonzalez. They both grew up in Laredo, Texas. Actually, from my father's part of the family, they were from what they say in Laredo, la gente de las minas de carbón. That's just north of Laredo, where there were a lot of mining towns. They were company-owned mining towns. And those mines shut down, I want to say that it was like the early 40s. And so those like whole communities moved into Laredo. And so there were like barrios in Laredo of people that had worked, or families had worked in the coal mining towns. But he was probably about, I don't know, I mean, he was pretty young when they moved to Laredo, so we say he's from Laredo. So they moved to Dallas in the early 50s.
What prompted that?
Well, they were very much encouraged by their teachers there in Laredo to leave Laredo and to get an education. I mean, you know, I always find that interesting as well. I mean, my grandparents had no education, and certainly didn't discourage, but didn't encourage, for instance, my dad to continue studying. But I always hear from him it was the teachers there in Laredo that encouraged them. A lot, it was kind of a common thing, a lot of his classmates did leave Laredo, and they would go to North Texas or TWU at the time to get education degrees, which quite a lot of them did. And so that's what prompted them to leave Laredo. And he went to college at North Texas and got his education degree there and did his master's work there.
You said earlier that your mom took you to political events when you were 8, 12. Tell me about that.
I think my mother just always loved politics, and she She would take me to rallies, and I can remember going to the George McGovern rallies and all kinds of political events. One of the events that really made a strong impact on me, and I was probably about the same age, I was about 12 years old. Here in Dallas, we had an incident where a 12-year-old, he was about 12 years old, was handcuffed for questioning, was arrested by Dallas police officer, and he and his brother were put in the car and questioned, and the officer played Russian roulette with the child and ended up shooting him in the head while he was handcuffed. And that was the case of Santos Rodriguez. It made a strong impact on me because I remember, being a child myself, being about the same age. It's the first memory I ever have of seeing my dad break down in tears. And I remember he said, all the work that we do for some idiot to take it away in a second. And he had taught, not Santos, but the older brother, when they were students at William B. Travis, at a school that my dad had taught at. And my dad, just being a different personality, didn't want to go to the rallies, didn't want to go to any of the protests, was just very, I think, kind of upset and devastated by it that he withdrew. But my mother took us to every rally and every meeting about the incident. She was so angry. And I remember that we went to that rally, the downtown rally, which ended up turning into a riot, really kind of the only riot that Dallas has had. And we got caught in the middle of the conflict. But I remember that day, that at the peaceful part of the rally, that at least the people that were speaking and that were promising to make a difference were attorneys, were lawyers, and it stuck with me, and it occurred to me that that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I wanted to be. And I didn't know, in terms of their promises that they were going to see that this would never happen again, whether they would, whether that would be true or not. But I guess, again, that's the part of me that's not cynical, the idealistic part of me that believed that it would happen.
Do you remember who those attorneys were?
I remember one of them was Adelfa Callejo, and being a woman, that made an impact on me, being that here was a woman attorney up there. And I don't recall, I know there were several others, but that was the one that I remember.
So what happened to you all during the riot phase? You only talked about the peaceful part, but you got caught in the middle.
What happened was, it was peaceful and it broke up. And so we went, being downtown Dallas, we went on our way. I think we either went to have lunch or went into a shop or something. When we came out, we were going to take the bus to go home. When we walked out, we were in the middle of the riot. I remember there was I could feel the big sense of panic with my mother because we couldn't get on a bus. All the buses were full because everybody was just trying to get out. I remember, I think it was like the Oakland bus or some bus going nowhere near where we were going. And the bus driver just made the people move back to get us on, just to get us off. But at the time, we didn't know whether there were gunshots or what, but all you could hear was just, what it was, I think, was people were just breaking the windows of all the stores. So we were kind of in a panic just to try to get out of there, out of downtown. And we eventually got out and, ended up getting and had to take two or several buses to finally get back home.
When were you born?
In 1960.
And your brother and sister's names?
Uh-huh. I have a brother, Mark Orozco, and he was born in 1955 here in Dallas. And a sister that's a year and a half older than I'm, born in 1959 here in Dallas, Sylvia Orozco Joseph. And my brother teaches deaf children with the school district and has for, probably over 20 years now at the same school. He teaches deaf children with behavioral problems. And then my sister works for the Mental Health Association, and she coordinates a program called, it's the WHO program, We Help Ourselves, that basically trains teachers to teach kids with the program, with puppets, about victimization and child victimization and teaching kids how to ask for help or say no, stranger danger and things like that.
Any other significant events in your early childhood life? Involved with the church, involved with Girl Scouts, involved with quinceañeras, dating?
No, nothing significant, let me think.
High school debate team, homecoming queen, cheerleader, anything?
Oh, I mean, I was very active in high school, and I always said, you know, I think that my hidden dream that I always had was to be a ballerina and to be a dancer. But I think I was 5 years old when I cracked my ankle because they put me in ballet classes and I didn't want to wait. I wanted to be on toe shoes, so I decided I was going to do the toe shoe thing, and I cracked my ankle. But you know, so like I said, I kind of lost that dream when I realized there were no 4'10" ballerinas, but I've always loved dancing and things like that. So, I mean, in high school, I was, you know, on the drill team and always participated in their musicals and things like that.
What school did you graduate from?
From high school, from Ursuline Academy.
So you went to private school?
I went to private school. I was on a work study scholarship at Ursuline. So, you know, I'd work and they'd knock off the tuition and then some scholarship money as well. After Ursuline, I got a scholarship to St. Mary's College in South Bend, Indiana, which was another big dream of mine, to go to Notre Dame, but actually St. Mary's was kind of the best of both worlds. You can take courses at Notre Dame, but the campus and facilities at St. Mary are all geared towards women, and the classes were smaller, so I just thoroughly enjoyed that experience. Through the University of Notre Dame, my sophomore year, and this was the best decision I ever made, was to go study in Mexico City. So I studied for a year, my sophomore year in college, at La Universidad Anáhuac in Mexico City, just the outskirts of Mexico City. Wow, that was a big experience. One reason it helped me a lot in terms of just, you know, you tend to lose your Spanish when you don't use it, and we didn't really grow up speaking as much Spanish as I wish we could have. So my Spanish was rusty, and it's still not as good as I'd like it to be, but that year in Mexico made a tremendous difference for me in terms of being able to speak Spanish. But then, my gosh, I mean, Mexico City in Mexico is an exciting place. I mean, it's like we said, we could do something different every day, every day that we were there, and we still wouldn't have seen, you know, very much of what there is to see. Got to travel a lot. It was a group of about 15 from Notre Dame and St. Mary's. So got to do a lot of traveling. We lived with the family, and so made a lot of friends, and it was a great experience.
Ursuline, was it predominantly Mexican American?
No. I was probably one of maybe five in a class of 125.
All girls?
All girls.
Yeah. Was there any culture shock, or what were the nuances of the culture shock at Indiana, Mexico City?
So got to do a lot of traveling. We lived with the family, and so made a lot of friends, and it was a great experience.
Ursuline, was it predominantly Mexican American?
No. I was probably one of maybe five in a class of 125.
All girls?
All girls.
Yeah. Was there any culture shock, or what were the nuances of the culture shock at Indiana, Mexico City?
There was, I mean, everyone said, was kind of preparing the group that they were going to go through culture shock going to Mexico City. And then they said, but you're not going to go through it. But that's not true. There are a lot of things. I mean, one is it's just the shock of the difference of living, let's say, in Dallas or South Bend and going to live in New York City. I mean, just in terms of getting used to the population. Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine what it is now. That was back in 1980, and think at that time the population was 8 million or something like that, 8 to 10 million. And yeah, I mean, that was an incredible thing to have to get used to, was just in terms of getting used to living with that population. But culture shock, I mean, it was a culture shock for me as well. Maybe not as bad as some of my roommate, for instance. But it still was a lot to get used to. We're very different, Mexicans from Mexican Americans.
So you graduated from St. Mary's College in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You said that during the Santo Rodriguez rallies, you saw lawyers, and you wanted to be one. Did you pursue that right away, or what happened after college?
I early on decided that that's what I wanted to do. I mean, even when I was at Ursuline, they had a government in action program. I got to work in the district attorney's office and get credit for it. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do with it, but I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. At St. Mary's as well, I majored in government and worked as well, doing part for their what would be their legal services program up there. Volunteered my time, so I was pretty much preparing for law school.
So where'd you go to law school?
SMU. Yeah.
How could you afford that?
Well, I had my heart set on going to the University of Texas. That's where I really wanted to go, and I had my advisors and so many people tell me it's tough to get into. I remember how excited SMU had accepted me and had offered me a scholarship. It was a partial scholarship. It was a good scholarship. And I remember I don't think my family wanted to even speak to me, because I told them, the day I found out I got accepted at UT Law School, I said, I don't care if I have to get a loan. I'm going to UT. I'm not going to SMU. And what happened is that it was during spring break. I got a call from SMU, and they said, this is the first year that through the Dallas Bar Association and the Dallas Bar Foundation and SMU, it's the first year that we're going to offer a special scholarship. It pays for all tuition, room and board, and all books. And I said, well, what's the name of the scholarship? And they said, the Sarah Hughes Fellowship. And I thought, oh my God. I said, oh, definitely, definitely I'll accept it. And kind of the story about that, when I was telling you, my mother used to always encourage me, and that was kind of one of the people, she used to talk about Adele Facallejo being a woman, being an attorney, but the other person my mother would always talk about that she was so impressed with was Sarah Hughes. And she used to always tell me she used to be a police officer, she's, a judge, she's a woman, and she used to always hold this person out to me as, I guess as a role model. And so when I heard that they were going to name this after Sarah Hughes, which is someone I had always heard about all my life, then, I thought, wow, this is a big honor. And so,
well, what particular problems have you encountered as a woman?
It's hard to say sometimes, because sometimes you don't know if it's because you're a Hispanic or because you're a woman, but I don't know. I think I don't really feel that I've encountered that many problems. Obviously, there are some things, some attitudes and some things of either judges or colleagues, attorneys, that upset some women. They don't really upset me. I really haven't felt that type of discrimination.
And on the bench, have you encountered some resistance to your being a female?
And I guess that's the thing. You never know why people react, why they react. And some people, I think, they come in here and they see me and they, you're too young to be a judge. I don't know if that's what they're reacting to. Sometimes I feel like I get people that come in here and perhaps don't treat me with the respect, don't treat me, or I tend to think, I wonder if they would have acted that way if I were a man and sitting up there. But it's hard to say why. So, and it doesn't happen that often. So, I really haven't experienced that kind of.
So when did you graduate from SFU as a lawyer?
That was in 85.
And then did you take the bar promptly, and what happened?
I took the bar, and I passed the hardest section first and had to retake the second section, but pretty much started practicing. I'm trying to think. I think the first job I had was worked with another Hispanic attorney and worked with him.
Who was that?
Al Mendez. Yeah, okay. I worked with Al for a couple of years then. I did that really just for, I think, a couple of years, and then went on my own, officed with Adelfa Callejo for a couple of years, and then eventually left her office and stayed in my own practice.
What were some of the accomplishments and problems of being a solo practitioner?
You know, and being a solo practitioner, and then the other experience that I've had serving on the grievance committee, I don't think law schools do a good job of preparing attorneys for actual practice. It was a good situation, and I think it is a good situation when you have someone that you're officing with that can assist you or help you in getting started. But I think especially now it's tough, I think, to practice law and be in your own practice. And I at least from the bench too, I see a lot of attorneys out there that basically still need a lot of training and a lot of help.
Did you ever meet your grandparents?
Yes.
Who are they, and mm-hmm. where are they from?
On my father's side, as I said earlier, my grandfather was born in Mineta, Texas, which doesn't exist, and it was Mineta, Texas, because it was a mining town. And it's really literally just up the road from where my dad was born, which was Dolores, Texas, which was another mining town. They're basically on the other side, the river is right there, from Colombia, which is now where there is a bridge, but before there was not that access. My grandmother was born just on the other side, so a town neighboring Colombia, the other side of Mexico, and her name is Dora Perez. She is still living. She's 93. My grandfather died when he was 90. So very special people in my life.
Are they here in Dallas with you now?
My grandmother's here in Dallas. My grandfather died here in Dallas, yeah. So, we grew up with them. I always look at their life and all the sufferings and all that they didn't have, and I think you would think these people would be very bitter people, very angry people, but they were, and they, like my grandma, the most, I guess because they had to live with so little, they learned how important community was. And, you know, my grandmother still, I can remember one time going by to see my grandmother, and there was some lady in her house, and the lady had been there all day, and she's like, what is this? Well, this lady was off the street, and she was lost, and so she just came in and had breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and just, you know, but that was the way they survived, by helping each other. And, you know, very generous and very open people. And they had no education, they had nothing, but what they did with what they had is just, you know, it's tremendous. They're really special to me in my life.
Grandparents on the mother's side?
On my mother's side, I didn't know them as well. My grandfather, I only met a few times, and he passed away, and I wasn't as close to them. They stayed and lived in Laredo. My grandfather was in San Antonio, my grandmother lived in Laredo. So we didn't have as close contact with them.
Two sensitive areas, and I'll defer to whatever remarks you want to make. You've had a falling out with Adelfa, and you have a conflict with Aurelio Castillo, the constable for this area. You care to comment about the professional aspects of these differences or disagreements?
Well, my falling out with Adelfa, really, it was kind of anyone who's known Adelfa, eventually has some, it's the falling out, the only falling out was she didn't support me when I ran for this district. But again, the person I ran against, Mr. Garza, more of her colleague and her age group, I guess I can understand why she would support him over me. So that was that falling out at that period of time. I think it's not really a falling out with Adelfa as much as it is. Adelfa tends to, at least with me, on a very personal level, I think it almost becomes like a mother-daughter relationship. And like any parent-child relationship, because of the difference in age, when you try to assert yourself or just say, look, I disagree with you, sometimes it's difficult, I think, for the parent, the person in the parent role to accept that and not take it personally. So no, I mean, I think since the period of time that she didn't support me, I mean, we don't talk every day, we don't talk every month, but we agree on things, and there are things that we don't agree on. It's not like we're angry at each other, we don't work with each other on certain things. So the issue with the constable, though, is different, and I would say that is a definite falling out. And I think it brings a very important issue, and that is, you know, the community and the leadership, Hispanic leadership of this community, has to fight pretty hard to get these single member districts. And as I said, these things are not, I mean, who knows if we're going to be able to keep them the way that the law is coming down, some of these conservative opinions. And we fight for the opportunity to have Hispanic elected officials. And I'm not saying we've had our share of whites and of all colors that are incompetent or that mess up. I'm not saying that as well, that we're supposed to be above all that. But what I am saying is, and that comes down to an issue of integrity as well, we've got to be able to be honest and to speak out, and that when someone is doing wrong, no matter what color they are, to be able to speak out about it. And what I see, or at least my experience, is, well, he's our first elected Hispanic constable, he's a Hispanic, you know, we shouldn't say anything about it, or we should be very low-key, even though we know that some of the things he may be doing ends up hurting our own people, or just hurting people, and that we know the things that he's doing are incompetent, that we're not supposed to say anything. I take that to be a very bad double standard. And that if we're going to, for instance, now I'll give you a good example. One of the issues that I was very concerned about, because I live in this community and I would see it with my own eyes, was that he took on, instead of trying to slowly learn the position, which their main job is to serve process for the JP courts or for the courts, he got on this kick that they were going to do law enforcement. Well, I mean, I saw this with my own eyes. And at least the people that I saw them stop seemed to be immigrants. They would stop them, pull them out of the car, throw them out. It looked like a drug bust. These were traffic stops. My concern in the issues I raised was, what are these people's training? What was the probable cause? There were many complaints about stops made without probable cause. Okay, here's the double standard. Here's where we look like hypocrites. If Aurelio Castillo were a white man and decided law enforcement was going to be a big deal, and we saw them out there stopping immigrants and treating them in that way, I can tell you that Domingo Garcia and a lot of us would be out there protesting that that's not right. And that they, and in fact, Domingo Garcia was one of the people who headed the committee about deadly force. When do you use deadly force? The deadly force policy for the city. When minorities had a lot of conflict with the Dallas Police Department. Things are much better now. We have a great chief of police, but in the past we've had some real problems. And that's just one example of what I'm saying. The fact that he's Hispanic, but if he's out there with untrained officers who are stopping people without probable cause, how does it really matter to our people that the person that's stopping them is Hispanic and or is white? It doesn't matter one bit. They're still being, you know, I think, abused. And that's one of so many examples of what I see and what I think is wrong, that regardless of whether it's one of our own, that if they're doing wrong, we've got to speak out.
Okay. Personal issues. Who are you married to now? Were you married before? Who was that?
You don't want to know.
Okay. Well, whatever. It's your archive, your interview.
Okay. I'm married to an attorney, Bill Garrett, William Garrett. He was an attorney and did a lot of voting rights cases here in the state of Texas, but I guess that's a thing of the past now. I don't know what the way the law is, but no. And we have, Bill has a son, a 17-year-old son, so I have a stepson named Tito. It's William Tomas, so okay. They call him Tito. I have a son, Mark, named him after my brother. Bill has a brother named Bobby or Robert, so we named him after our brothers, Mark Robert Garrett, and he's 2 and a half. And I'm expecting a girl in about 3 weeks.
What's her name?
And I have no idea what her name's going to be.
Call her Asu.
I have no idea. I have no idea.
All right, well, I don't have any other questions. Do you have an area that we didn't discuss fully or something you want to add on your own, statement you want to make?
No.
Well, when we set up the interview, you did mention that you had photographs from your grandparents' mm-hmm. days and early father days. Mm-hmm. I want to remind you that this is your archive. The principal purpose is your archive, so we would welcome you to take advantage of this for putting your papers and your documents and your things about who Diana Orozco has been and will continue to be.
Okay. I was just telling you that my grandfather had saved some old photographs from when they lived in the mines, and so I took them and got negatives and have had them reproduced, and they're just some neat pictures.
We'd love to have them. Well, thank you very much for the interview, Judge. I know you're busy and uncomfortable.
Yeah. Can't and breathe. Out of breath. Do I have what time? Yeah.
I'm sure. Thank you.
So when are you...